Welcome to the Conspiracy Files. I'm Jerry Pippin. In a moment, we'll be talking to Paris Flamand. He spent 2 years of his life down in New Orleans living and breathing with Jim Garrison, doing the investigation of the famed DA from New Orleans and the subject of that Oliver Stone movie, JFK. Flamand wanted to find out what made Garrison tick. What he found out was very interesting. Flamand has written Assassination of America, the Kennedy coup d'etat. It's the definitive story and an inside look at the Jim Garrison investigation. He delves into all of the JFK, RFK story and the assassinations and many details never before released by anyone else. It's available in several volumes. Before we talk with Paris, let's turn the hands of time back to November 29th, 1963, 1 week to the day after the murder of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. In this recording, we hear Lyndon B. Johnson talking with J. Edgar Hoover, who was director of the FBI. Listen closely, and you'll find the description of what happened in Dallas. Discussion about Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail. Oswald, of course, was accused of the assassination of Kennedy. Hoover reveals to Johnson that there actually was evidence that there were two Oswalds. He tells the president about Officer J.D. Trippett and how he was killed in the movie theater by Oswald shortly after the assassination. This is the actual recording, the actual phone conversation, as released by the LBJ Presidential Library.
This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble because the stories I have, this man, Oswald, getting $6,500 from the Cuban embassy and then coming back to this country with it. We're not able to prove that fact. The information was that he was there on the 18th of September in Mexico City, and we are able to prove conclusively he was in New Orleans that day. Now, then they changed the date. The story came in changing the date to the 28th of September, and he was in Mexico City on the 28th. Now, the Mexican police have again arrested this woman, Duran, who's a member of the Cuban embassy, and will hold her for 2-3 more days. And we've got to confront her with the original informant, who saw the money pass, so he says, and we're also going to put the lie detector test on him. Meantime, of course, Castro's hollering his head off.
Can you pay attention to those lie detector tests?
I would not pay 100% attention to them. All that they are is a psychological asset in an investigation. I wouldn't want to be a part to sending a man to the chair on a lie detector. For instance, we have found many cases where we've used them, and in a bank where there's been embezzlement, and a person will confess before the lie detector test is finished. They're more or less fearful of the fact that the lie detector test will show them guilty. Psychologically, they have that advantage because it's a misnomer to call it a lie detector, because what it really is, it's the evaluation of the chart that is made by this machine, and that evaluation is made by a human being. And any human being can be apt to make a wrong interpretation. So I would not myself go on that alone. If, on the other hand, if this fellow Oswald had lived and had taken me out of the lie detector test and it had shown definitely that he had done these various things, together with the evidence that we very definitely have, it would have just added that much more strength to it. There's no question but that he is the man. Now, the fingerprints and things we have. This fellow Rubenstein down there, he has offered to take the lie detector test, but his lawyer has got to be called to consult it first, and I doubt whether the lawyer will allow him. He's one of these criminal lawyers from the West Coast, and somewhat like an Edward Bennett Williams type, and almost as much of a shyster.
Mm-hmm. Have you got any relationship between the two here?
Between Rubenstein?
Yeah.
No, at the present time we have not. There was a story down there that...
Were you ever in his bar? Stuff like
there was a story that this fellow had been in this nightclub, this strip tease joint that he has, but that has not been able to be confirmed. Now, This fellow Rubenstein is a very shady character, has a bad record, street brawler, fighter, that sort of thing. And in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He's what I would put in the category, one of the egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joint thawed in there. And he also let them come in, see the show, get food, and get liquor and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters. Because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason raised no question. Because they never made any moves as the picture show, even when they saw him approaching this fella, and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any move to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, so to say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't. And, those derelictions in that phase. But so far as tying Rubenstein and Oswald together, we haven't as yet done so. There have been a number of stories come in. We've tied Oswald into the Civil Liberties Union in New York, membership into that, and then, of course, into this this Cuban Fair Play Commission committee, which was pro-Castro and dominated by communism and financed to some expense by the Castro government.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No, there was another.
All three at the president?
All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splintered, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun. The third shot, which hit the president, he was hit by the first and the third. The second shot hit the governor. The third shot is a complete bullet that wasn't shattered, and that's rolled out of the president's head. It tore a large part of the president's head off, and in trying to massage his heart at the hospital, on the way to the hospital, they apparently loosened that, and that fell onto the stretcher, and we recovered that. And we have that, and we have the gun here also.
Were they aiming at the president?
They were aiming directly at the president. There's no question about that. This telescopic lens that I've looked through, it brings a person as close to you as if they were sitting right beside you. And we also have tested the fact that you could fire, those three shots were fired within 3 seconds. There have been some stories going around in the papers and so forth that that must have been more than one man, but because no one man could fire those shots from the time that they were fired. We've just proved that by the actual test that we made.
How did it happen? They hit Connolly.
Connolly turned to the president when the first shot was fired. And I think in that turning was where he got hit.
He hadn't turned, he probably wouldn't have got hit.
I think that's very likely.
When the president got hit second?
No, the president wasn't hit with the second one.
If Connolly hadn't been in his way.
Oh, yes. The president no doubt would have been hit.
He'd been hit three times.
He'd been hit three times. You know, on the fifth floor of that building where we found the gun and the wrapping paper in which the gun was wrapped, and upon which we find the full fingerprints of this man Oswald, on that floor we found the three empty shells that had been fired and one shell that had not been fired. In other words, there were four shells apparently, and he had fired three but didn't fire the fourth one. He then threw the gun aside, came down, and at the entrance of the building, he was stopped by a police officer, and some manager in the building told the police officer, well, he's all right, he works for you, you needn't hold him. So they let him go. That's how he got out. Mm-hmm. And then he got on a bus, the bus driver has identified it, and went out to his home, and got hold of a jacket that he wanted for some purpose, and came back downtown, walking downtown, and the police officer who was killed stopped him, not knowing who he was and not knowing whether he was the man, but they were just on suspicion, and he fired, of course, and killed the police officer. yes. Oh, yes, we can prove that. Then he walked about another two blocks and went to the theater. And the woman at the theater window selling the tickets, she was so suspicious way he was acting. And she said he was carrying a gun. He had a revolver at that time, with which he had killed the police officer. He went into the theater, and then she notified the police. And the police and our man down there went in there and located this particular man. He had quite a struggle with him. He fought like a regular lion. And he had to be subdued, of course. And his brother was then brought out, of course, taken to the police headquarters. But he apparently had come down the five flights of steps, stairway, from the fifth floor. So far as we found out, the elevator was not used, although he could have used it. But nobody remembers whether it was or whether it wasn't.
Well, your conclusion is... He's the one that did it. B, the man he's after was the president. C, he would have hit him three times except the government turned.
I think that's correct.
Four, that there's no connection between he and Ruby that you can detect now. And five, whether he was connected with the Cuban operation with money you were trying to...
That's what we're trying to nail down now. Because he was strongly pro-Castro. He was strongly anti-American. And he had been in correspondence, which we have, with the Soviet embassy here in Washington, and with the American Civil Liberties Union, and with this committee for fair play to Cuba. We have copies of the correspondence. So we've got him nailed down in his contact with them. None of those letters, however, dealt with any indication of violence or contemplated assassination. They were dealing with the matter of a visa for his wife to go back to Russia.
In a moment, we'll be back to delve into the investigation of the killing of JFK and RFK. Paris Flamand is our guest, the consummate expert on the Kennedy assassinations. Don't go away. Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, you know, a picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Marv picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Marv Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMarv.com. Real easy.
The Assassination of America, a series of in-depth books by Paris Flamand, a noted author and expert on JFK and RFK, and Jim Garrison. It's hard to believe that Robert F. Kennedy was killed 40 years ago, and we just passed 45 years on President Kennedy. Before we get to the reason that he calls it the Kennedy coup d'etat, let's get to know the man, Paris Flamand. Paris, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Pretty good. You're quite a legend, and it's an honor having you here.
It's my pleasure.
And we're going to talk about a few things here, but I would be remiss if we didn't bring up your entire career. You hung around Greenwich Village and knew quite a few interesting people, I take it.
Actually, dozens. They have ranged from scientific people, theatrical people, science fiction writers. I knew many of them. Almost all of the flying saucer kooks, sports people. Living in New York.
And a virtual who's who of entertainment, from Jacqueline Suzanne to Jackie Gleason to Johnny Carson, you name it.
Right. Well, so many of them lived or worked there. You have to remember that during that period, that was the metropolis of broadcasting, and now, of course, so much of it has gone out to the West Coast with television, but in radio days, almost everybody worked out of New York, and so it wasn't surprising that one might meet a good many of them.
Oh, I know that. When I was a young man, I decided I would go to New York and be a stand-up comic, and hung around a place called, I'm trying to remember, it was a 55 Grove, I do know that, in the Village, and it was an upstairs little room where they did showcases. And I, for the life of me, can't remember the name of the place, but there were some pretty famous people even back in those days, 67, 68.
Are you talking about a cafe, live performances?
Yes. Uh-huh. And so most of the listeners that weren't around during that time or didn't live in New York.
That's very true.
They just they don't understand how much of an action place that was.
Well, John had was estimated generally at around 26 million listeners, and 95% of them were east of the Mississippi. But because of some atmospheric phenomena that occasionally occurred, skip signal, and we get messages from California and Arizona.
Well, I used to try to pick up Long John Neville in here in Oklahoma, and you can do it. And you could do it some night on a skip, especially when in. I believe it was before he went over to NBC. I think it's when he's on WOR at the time.
Yes. Well, his great years were at OR. The NBC attracted him by a absurd amount of money, and they built a new studio for him and everything. And it was just not his métier. It was was not the old show. It was not the peak of his career. As a matter of fact, thereafter, when his contract ran out, they renewed it once, and then it wasn't renewed again because he simply didn't have the feeling for that place that he had had for the old, rather beat-up studio over at WOR.
At one time, he was actually out of New Jersey, right?
Yes, well, he began in 1956. I'll try to make this in a matter of a few seconds. The vice president of WOR, for reasons I don't recall, was driving around out in New Jersey, and he saw this enormous sign about 50 or 60 feet long, which simply said Long John Neville, and he drove into the parking area to see what it was. And John had a huge auction operation out there in which he sold virtually anything you can think of in an auction format. And Bob Smith was so impressed with the skill of John as a pitchman, he suggested that he come on and do a 15-minute radio spot at the transmitter out in Carteret, New Jersey. John did about four shows, and they spread it to an hour. And within 6 months, they pulled him from out there to the main.
So they took him into Manhattan, and he did 5.5 hours ultimately.
Yeah, well, that was the 1440 Broadway, just below Times Square. And the minute he came into the main studio, he did the there was a period of about a month or so. He did a 4-hour shift. They ran from 12 to 4, and then they spread it down to 5. On rare occasions, he even did to 5:30. And but for all those decades, he did 5 hours a night, usually six nights a week, occasionally only 5. And Sunday was always a repeat tape.
Now, how did you get involved with him?
Well, that's another odd story. I arrived in the Village when I was about 18, and after a decade, a rather erratic and erotic decade, I simply decided that I needed to withdraw entirely from society and just meditate on what I was going to do with the rest of
it. In other words, Greenwich Village finally got you down.
Yes.
It's quite a lifestyle there.
So I took a room on the fifth floor just north of the Village on 23rd Street, my closest friend, a poet named Loco Raley. And he used to bring me occasional news of what was going on and what have you, but I really saw almost nobody. And but I listened to the radio a lot, mostly music. But one night I happened to happened on to John's show, and found it rather entertaining. And one of his people misquoted John Keats, which irritated me. So I just scribbled off a postcard, and my friend Loker mailed it for me. And about 10 days later, the landlady climbed all those stairs and said, "There's a telephone call for you." And I said, "I don't take calls." And so the next day, she came back again. She said, "They're calling again." And I said, "Who is it?" And she said, "It's a radio." So I said, "Well, I won't bother you with all that." But eventually, I went through his producer, his secretary, etc. And finally, I answered the phone, and it was John himself. And his opening line was, well, I can't say exactly what it is. And in effect, why in the hell don't you want to answer the goddamn phone?
Right.
I said, because I'm not socializing. I'm not involved with people these days. And we talked for a little while and got along rather well. And he talked me into coming up and doing a guest shot on the show. And as he put it, as a village poet, we've never had anything like that on the show before. And I said, I bet you haven't. And so I went up, and we got along famously, and it was a very successful show. And so I
one thing led to another.
Well, I started simply being one of the regular panelists. I was on, generally speaking, about once every 10 days, and that got down to about once or twice a week.
So for people who aren't familiar with that, I imagine it'd be more akin to the old Jack Parr show. You have several people on a panel who may or may not be well known, and they would be regulars, right?
There's nothing like it today, because A, it ran for 5 hours. B, it had a regular a guest, a moderator, but it also had three or four panelists that were rotated. We had a stable of about, at one point, probably 30 panelists, a dozen of them being specialists, but we had about 8 or 10 or 12 that were rotated regularly.
And so all of those panelists became regular characters, and people would enjoy listening to them as well as what they were saying.
Absolutely. They became personalities. They got the fan mail, and people would, when we had call-ins, people would call in to ask about or criticize one or the other of them. And after about 6 or 7 months, John's producer, who was tended to be fond of the bottle, simply became inefficient. And John, much to my surprise, because it was not my field of activity at all, asked if I would be interested in producing the show. And it kind of intrigued me. As I say, I had not done anything like that before. I'd done live performance direction and what have you, but never anything on radio except the appearances I'd been making. And I accepted, and I was with him for it was almost 5 years.
How did you get your name, Paris? That's an unusual.
My father was a literary scholar, and he took it from the Greek legend of Paris and Helen.
Interesting. Interesting.
Actually, Vincent Desmond Paris de Flamont.
The reason, you know, we'll probably end up doing several shows over the years here, because you know a lot of people. I do a lot of entertainment shows, and we'll get to that. But I wanted to talk to you basically about the JFK thing and your book. Tell us a little bit about this book. It's actually more than just a book.
Well, originally it was a book called The Kennedy Conspiracy. That was the first book on Garrison's investigation, and about the fourth or fifth book on the conspiracy, as you know, the Kennedy case itself. And the book that it's actually four volumes, 1,850 pages, 150 pages of more than 400 photographs and graphs, etc. I mean, it's a monumental work. It took me about 3.5 years to do it, and although compared to the speed with which some people write, that was pretty fast. But as I say, it's a four-volume work, and the title, of course, is The Assassination of America.
Now, it's available on your website.
It is available on my website. And
and we'll give that website again here in a minute. We already have once, but the four volumes, that's a lot.
It is.
And 1,600 and some odd pages, that's a lot.
Well, the first volume is completely concentrated on the actual killing and Dallas and everything surrounding that. The second volume is on Garrison's investigation, and the third volume is on the analysis of who, why, what, when, and where the likely persons responsible for the act. And the last volume is index and indices, 30 appendices and photographs of 75 of the best-known critics and biographies of about 30 of them, and all reviews of the Posner books and the Zugolosi books, four or five reviews by prominent critics in the last book.
Now, when we talk about it had to be a monumental job just going over those 400 frames that you put in that book.
And of course, it has interminable bibliography, and if it's something you feel should be in a total survey of the case, it's there.
Well, we're going to talk about it for a little while here, if it's okay with you. It took you a long time to put this together. How did you meet Jim Garrison?
I was contracted to do a book called The Age of Flying Saucers, which was a historical study on that entire phenomenon.
Yeah, we're going to do a show about that some night. You know, a lot of my shows deal with this subject, and late night radio, back in the 50s, did as well.
Well, of course, that was one of John's pet subjects.
Yeah.
And we had every contactee known to man on it, mostly 4, 5, 10 times. If you're familiar with that era, George Adamski and George King and
sure.
Dan Fry, and we had all of them on over and over and over again.
Yeah, Dr. King, I know about him, and George Adamski, of course.
We had Howard Manger and his wife on, and God, there's so many, it's hard for me to...
Now, back in the 50s, a lot of our listeners wouldn't know this, but this was a hot topic all the way from 47 of Roswell, the big flap in 52. It was in the major papers, pictures of UFOs over Washington, D.C. Do you remember that?
That 19, July 1952.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing was that during the very hot period for saucers, as distinguished from UFOs, separate subject, allied but separate. The saucer period went right through the 50s and into the late 60s. The preoccupation with Roswell actually didn't begin until the very late 60s. They were, it's curious, but so much of that was covered up. That it was just, although I do cover it in my book, it was still, there were so many instances of phenomena that one did not particularly stand up. People were much more interested in the Maury Island case, for example, than the Roswell case. So it became what it is today.
Yeah.
Only in the last 25.
Like I said, we're going to do a show about that sometime. But what kind of guy was Long John? Was he a tall guy?
Yes, 6'3".
Okay.
And slender as a rail, and always in very good shape. And he never exercised.
Well, what were some of his favorite topics? I guess the UFOs, the flying saucers.
Well, UFOs, flying saucers, magic. He did a great many shows on medicine. There's no branch of medicine you could think of that he didn't show, do shows on. He didn't do the celebrity bit that Barry Gray and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was totally uninterested in people because they had publicists. He did have some people on that were well known, but only because he thought they were interesting, not because they were celebrities.
Well, now, you know, in that 50s and 60s time, reading your stuff, I detected some excitement there, but you and I corresponded a little bit by email since then, and you pointed out it was just an exciting time, and you happened to be in Greenwich Village, and I guess that is true.
Yeah, well, I was meeting so many interesting people. In those days, I knew Steve McQueen, for example. I knew John Carradine, a character actor. So many painted. Well, I also among the poets, I knew two of the last of the five great poets. I knew W. H. Auden. I'm speaking very casually, not as a deep personal friendship, but I had spent time sitting on a bench in Washington Square talking with him about verse, and I knew E. E. Cummings very, very casually. So they were. You know, it was a place of celebrities, as well as people that no one has ever heard of, who were almost as interesting as the celebrities, in some cases more so.
Well, you know, I've been doing talk shows for 45 years, and I've done my share of celebrity shows. I used to do broadcast out of Las Vegas full-time. However, I find that the really interesting shows are with people that you never heard of, that for lack of a better term, are experiencers, not only in UFOs and ETs, but anything, conspiracies or whatever.
Well, I agree with you completely, because the simple truth is, unfortunately, it's somewhat disillusioning, but celebrities that are theatrical, movie people and stage people are more interesting, but movie people in general, once you get them out of their roles, they're just not very interesting people. And, of course, that doesn't apply to a writer or who has to think
sure.
to do his work. But you don't have to think to be a good actor. And it reminds me of an anecdote about Vincent Price was in the restaurant, and he saw this kid, what he thought of as a kid, sitting at the bar, and he seemed to be very kind of unhappy, concerned, etc. And he walked over, and he knew he'd seen him before. And when the kid turned around, he realized that it was this young man that had just come out through the coast named James Dean, whom I also knew, by the way. And he said, "What's the matter, Mr. Dean, or Jimmy, or whatever you called him?" He said, "Well, I have this role coming up, and I'm trying to really, you know, get inside the character. I'm trying to really understand it." And he went on like this for a couple of minutes. And Price said, "Well, I have a suggestion." And the dean said, what is that, Mr. Price?" He said, "Well, why don't you try acting?" That applied to so many,
sure.
The level of intelligence among people
right.
still leaves a lot to be desired.
November 22nd, 1963, were you guys doing a show that night?
Well, when
Kennedy was shot.
When he was killed, I had a studio in Greenwich Village.
Hold on a minute, Paris. We have to take a break. But when we come back, let's pick it up with the news about where you were when you heard that John F. Kennedy had been killed.